spend on the Ukrainian conflict. They have money to spend on the Zionist regime, billions and billions of dollars. So this clearly shows that this is not a democracy. This, to this date, is clear fascism. Fascism of the capitalist, fascism of lobbyists that control these puppets. They have these masters of puppets who are trying to control the world, but they are now miserably failing. And Ukraine is a clear example of that. Ukraine is not equipped to fight Russia. They are not. Russia hasn't even used its full power as of yet. Winter is coming. They need to start focusing on themselves than think of Iran.
Indeed. I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for that. Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist there from Houston, Texas. Masoud Shajar, a pleasure. Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikava Tagway and the team. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina tawaffahumu al-malaa'ikatu ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا المسلمين المستضعفين من الرجال والنساء والولدان لا يستطيعون حيلة ولا يهتدون سبيلا فأولئك عسى الله أن يعفو عنهم وكان الله عفوا غفورا صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Surely as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious so that you should have migrated therein?" So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Russia launches dozens of missiles at targets across Ukraine, including in the capital Kiev, as Ukrainian forces intensify shelling of eastern regions. The Belgian capital witnesses a protest organized by several trade unions over pay and working conditions. Also ahead, Germany's finance ministry says the country's public deficit will grow by 3.2% of the GDP next year. Our top story, Ukraine says it has shot down the majority of missiles fired by Russia in the latest flurry of such attacks. The chief commander of Ukraine's armed forces says 60 out of 76 Russian missiles were intercepted and destroyed. In southern Ukraine, two people lost their lives after a Russian rocket hit a residential building in Kryvyi Rih city. Meanwhile, in the Russian-controlled eastern Lugansk region, Ukrainian shelling of a village has killed at least 11 people and wounded around 20 others. That's according to pro-Russia forces, who called the attack barbaric. Moscow and Kiev have stepped up air attacks against each other's positions in recent weeks. Ukraine says the Russian attacks have heavily damaged its energy infrastructure, causing widespread water and power cuts. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets in the Belgian capital, Brussels, demanding higher wages amid rising energy prices and soaring inflation. Earlier, we discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a quick listen to that.
And I welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Thousands protest on the streets of Brussels demanding more support to deal with a growing cost of living crisis. Many of those who took part questioned how the EU can send billions of euros to Ukraine while neglecting the basic needs of its citizens across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Protest through Brussels on Friday was organised by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now joining us for the program is Faraiye Mvuti, CEO of the South African Times, joining us from London, and Marcia Baker, economic expert, joining us from Washington. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Marcia, we're going to start with you, this crippling cost of living crisis in the European Union, and we see citizens from every single country complaining about the Ukraine war. It's putting the pinch on their energy costs, bringing energy insecurity throughout the 27-nation bloc, not to mention the inflation and cost of living crisis, that a lot of it goes back to that Ukraine war. Your initial thoughts on this?
Yes. There's no question that the sanctions against Russia and other sanctions are the cost of this impossible situation in Europe and elsewhere for food and fuel. But this is like number three of a wave of three factors in recent years contributing to this that shows you how incompetent and evil the leadership in Brussels of the European Union is, and national governments like in Belgium and in Britain. A few years ago came the proposal to shut down nuclear power, saying it was unsafe, as in Germany. This is crazy. Belgium shut a nuclear plant that had no reason to be shut in September, and another one is due. Then, secondly, on top of it, came the European Union orders to go green with solar and wind, which is not reliable. It's useful in parts of the planet, but unreliable. Then the sanctions came on top of that. And so now you have absolutely impossible situation. This has to be rolled back. The fact of the central banks, the European Central Bank and the Bank of England yesterday and the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C., all raising interest rates on top of the fact they've already caused inflation through mega bailouts. This is like putting on the brakes and the accelerator in your car at the same time. This, all of these policies have to be changed.
Thank you, ma'am. And Mr. Mvuti, welcome to the program, sir. You're out there in London. We know the UK is no longer obviously part of the European Union, but nevertheless, it is not exempt, obviously, from this catastrophe, this cost of living crisis and inflation. We know the nursing union is about to walk out for 2 days. in their first time, their union is walking over 100,000 nurses. Over 106 years, they've never had a walkout. They're doing it now. We know rail workers have done it, crippling transportation. We know paramedics are doing it, along with other sectors. Tell us your initial thoughts on how things are unfolding out in the UK.
Well, thank you again for having me. Well, in terms of the walkout from the nurses, that actually began today. So we're going to see that, and it's not just the nurses. We've had rail strikes, we'll have rail worker strikes, that is, and ambulances. It spreads across to fire stations and so forth when it comes to the staffing levels. So that's going to, of course, impact not only just the aspect of staffing levels, which is already a crisis as you speak. Europe has faced an inflation in as far as its ability to recruit staff. So that's going to further increase. And part of the reasons why there are these strikes, a majority of the unions are asking for greater pay, but equally they're asking for better equipment to be able to deliver quality services. But this all stems from, as my colleague had said earlier, the policy approach when it comes to the issue in Russia and Ukraine. The mere policy that stampedes the ability of the UK and Europe to have access to cheaper oil and gas has an impact, a direct impact on wages, because it raises inflation. And as a consequence, now we're seeing quite a high number of people looking at this quite closely and thinking, because of the dire situation they're currently going, how much of an impact it will have going further. And I don't see that there will be any policy shifts, especially because of the political spin that has gone into the campaign against Russia. Well, this is not to suggest that Russia is right or wrong. It's purely to analyze it as it exists. Currently, the UK continues to have a high level of unemployment. Unemployment figures continue to increase. The government has completely lost goodwill. So this is possibly a government whose polling has gone lower than within a space of the last 20 years. We've never seen such low numbers in as far as the way the government is polling, which speaks directly to its economic policies. And as you know, earlier this year, we've had Boris Johnson to Liz Truss, and now we have Rishi Sunak. And that is directly the causation, of course, being the instability, not only from an ideological perspective within the political landscape, but more so with the unsettled realities that the population has to face.
All right, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Barcia Baker, economic expert, joining us out of Washington, D.C., and Farai Ian Mvuti, CEO from the Southern African Times. They're joining us out of London.
Meanwhile, Germany says its public deficit will grow to 3.25% next year as the energy crunch pushes the government to dip further down into its pockets. Finance Minister Christian Lindner warned that if government spending goes up, that figure could even reach 4.5%. The government has unveiled a 200 billion Euro plan to dampen the effect of soaring energy prices for the public. Part of the plan is to put a cap on gas prices for households and businesses. However, German economy is still expected to contract by 0.4% in 2023. The country expects its net borrowing to climb above 45 billion euros, nearly triple the initial estimates. Economic analyst Kirsha Campbell says the growth in Germany's public deficit has its roots in the country's over-reliance on Russia's gas and decisions by the central bank in Berlin.
When you think of certain dynamics or decisions or practices that were taking place in Germany, we realize that there could have been other decisions to mitigate this impact at this time. So, for example, when we think of Germany, it's a primarily industrial country. So you have the chemical sector, they're relying on natural gas. And we look further, we see that Germany was relying on Russia for most of that natural gas, most of that energy. So that, again, is a red flag. If, as a country, you are relying on a source for, let's say, 70 or 80% of a certain supply, that is a huge red flag. Because if negotiations go sour, if things go downwards, then you're in a problem. And this is one of the foundations that was shaky, and that has led to Germany being in this situation. Another thing which I will comment on is the impact and the role of the central bank. So think of like a parent and a child, right? You're, as a parent, you're responsible for your children. The central bank is responsible for certain policies in the country, interest rates, they manage inflation. So as the central bank, they are looking at various statistics, trends, making forecasts. So there are indicators that things are going downwards. We need to take action. We need to start having certain policies, certain remedies implemented quickly to mitigate, to lessen the impact overall of what is happening in the country and what it, where it's headed, right? So that is another thing I see, the role of the central bank and the choices, the decisions made, the policies that were adopted did impact, you know, the road to this situation for Germany.
And turning elsewhere, Israeli forces have attacked at least three villages near Nablus, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured following anti-settlement protests. We were earlier joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, who gave us more details on the incident.
Well, a number of anti-settlement protests had taken place in some Palestinian towns in Nablus area. We are speaking about a protest in the village of Beit Dajan, East Nablus, as well as another protest had taken place in the village of Osarin, South Nablus. In both the protests, Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians. They throw heavy tear gas and stun grenades, as well as rubber-coated bullets in order to disperse the protesters. According to Palestinian paramedics, a number of Palestinians had been wounded, mainly had suffocated due to inhaling tear gas in the village of Osarin. 15 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces in the village of Beit Dajan, East Nablus. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank and also in one of the villages near Nablus, This time, the Israeli settlers have attacked Palestinians in the village, of, in two villages, in the village of Madama and Bunin, South Nablus, under the protection of Israeli forces. When Palestinians had been taking place in a protest in order to express their anger and rejection of the settlement and the confiscation of their land, this time the settlers, under the protection of Israeli forces, have attacked the Palestinians, and a number of Palestinians had been wounded.
Turning to Peru now, where the country's Congress has rejected a bill to hold early elections, which was aimed at ending deadly protests over the ouster of President Pedro Castillo. The proposal was to move the elections from 2026 to December 2023. It fell short of the 87 required votes. Castillo's successor, Dina Boluarte, had called for the snap vote to ease an ongoing unrest, which has so far killed 18. The Supreme Court has extended the pretrial detention of Castillo for another 18 months. The leftist ex-president was impeached and arrested after he announced plans to dissolve the Congress and rule by decree. The Peruvian Defense Ministry declared a 30-day state of emergency after all-out protests and roadblocks following Castillo's arrest last week. That brings an end to our World Bulletin. Thank you for staying tuned.
Wow. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Yemen's popular resistance Ansarullah movement has warned against the United States military presence in the country, saying Washington is playing a dangerous game as it insists on pursuing a policy of aggression while impeding the national peace process. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV reported, Ali Al-Ghahoum, a member of Ansarullah's political bureau, made the remarks during an exclusive interview with Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television network recently, saying the presence of U.S. troops in Bab al-Mandab and off the coast of Yemen poses a serious threat to maritime navigation. adding that it further proves Washington's aggressive policy against the impoverished country. He went on to say that Saudi Arabia's war and blockade against Yemen over the past 8 years has been fully coordinated by the U.S., noting that Riyadh is nothing but a tool in the hands of Washington to execute its policy of aggression with the participation of Israel, the U.K. and France. The Ansarullah official further noted that the U.S. and U.K.'s tendencies to keep the conflict ongoing and impose more embargo on Yemen demand the utmost national responsibility of enhancing steadfastness. He added, "If the Americans insist on aggression and blockade, the response will be in a way that achieves the required effect and sufficient pressure on the aggressor, whoever it may be." Al-Rahum further stated that our message to the Saudi-led coalition is that elusiveness, gaining time, changing tools, and all the aspects of aggression and conspiracies are unacceptable. We'll tell the aggressor countries not to rely on time and not to count on the deceptiveness of the United Nations and the U.S. envoys, as the overall equation is changing and the reality is different. He further pointed out that the only guarantor for the return of the ceasefire is that the demands of the Yemeni people and the rights be respected, which will open the prospects for peace, and there is no way to achieve this through deception. The UN-brokered truce between the Saudi-led coalition and Yemen first came into effect in April and has been extended twice since. In mid-October, Yemeni Foreign Minister Hesham Sharaf said there would be no talks about the extension of the six-month truce, which expired on October 2nd, unless the nation's legitimate demands were fully met. Saudi Arabia launched the devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi and crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen. While the Saudi-led coalition has failed to meet any of its objectives, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and has spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Washington and London have been providing the coalition with direct arms, logistical and political support, including through outfitting it with precision-guided ammunition that the Saudi-led forces have been using amply against Yemen's civilian population. Middle East Eye also wrote in this regard, more than 100 national organizations signed a letter recently calling on U.S. lawmakers to support a war powers resolution aimed at blocking U.S. military participation in the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. It's been almost 2 months since the U.N. brokered truce in Yemen expired. Violence on the ground is escalating, and there is still no formal mechanism preventing a return to all-out war, the letter said. In an effort to renew this truce and further incentivize Saudi Arabia to stay at the negotiating table, we urge you to bring the war powers resolution to end U.S. military participation in the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen, the letter added. We'll be right back.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Revelations from the battlefield.
Part 1.
When the United States first entered Afghanistan in 2001, I was 11 years old. When America invaded Iraq in 2003, I was 13 years old. Like many Americans my age, at the time I was given very simple reasons for these wars. Our soldiers were fighting terrorism, supporting democracy, and spreading peace. United States' involvement in the Middle East was presented to us as an unquestionably benevolent force for peace in the region. We graduated from high school and became old enough to vote and enlist in the military as President Obama replaced President Bush with promises to end the wars and close Guantanamo. We were welcomed into adulthood with the release of the WikiLeaks Afghan and Iraq War Diaries, which challenged the liberation narrative with chilling accounts of civilian death tolls, unreported friendly fire, and revelations from the battlefield. But in the decades since the Afghanistan and Iraq wars began, my generation has come of age in a country struggling to comprehend the true complexity behind these two conflicts. My classmates and I learned about the Vietnam War just as pundits were beginning to debate the parallels between Iraq and Vietnam. We learned about the My Lai massacre in the classroom and recoiled from the modern horrors of Bagram, Haditha, and Abu Ghraib on the nightly news. Crimes committed by soldiers who have returned to the U.S. suggest further urgency as more soldiers return from deployment and try to integrate into life outside the military. Were these crimes, both those committed in the theater of war and those committed in the U.S., isolated events committed by wayward soldiers? Or are they perhaps symptomatic of wider concerns with the U.S. military, its training and selection and supervision of its soldiers, its capacity to treat and screen for mental wounds, and its process for reintegrating soldiers into civilian life after deployment? What lessons should my generation of Americans and those that come after us draw from these wars, from the actions of our soldiers, and the best way forward as they return home? In November 2010, the U.S. Army charged five soldiers from its 5th Stryker Brigade with the killing and mutilation of several Afghan civilians for sport.
The soldiers, who called themselves the Kill Team, included Private First Class Andrew Holmes, who was 19 years old at the time of the killings, and Corporal Jeremy Morlock, who was 22.
As a defense attorney, I'm representing my clients, but I'm also a part of a broader search for truth. And I, too, am interested in the truth, and I'm interested in justice. And sometimes our job as defense attorneys is to ensure that justice is served. And by that, I mean that justice is not excessive.
Daniel Conway is a former Marine staff sergeant and a military defense lawyer. Conway has defended numerous soldiers accused of misconduct in Afghanistan and Iraq, including those charged in the Haditha massacre.
PFC Holmes was required to set up security on top of a hill. Now, his team leader, Corporal Morlock, ran to the bottom of the hill and decided, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, that on January 15th, 2010, PFC Holmes did not know what Corporal Morlock was about to do.
Conway represented Private Andrew Holmes in the Stryker 5 case. As the Stryker 5 soldiers faced court-martial proceedings in 2011, Der Spiegel and Rolling Stone published gruesome pictures of the soldiers posing with the bodies of murdered Afghans. On January 15, 2010, Corporal Morlock and the so-called Kill Team murdered the first of three Afghan civilians. For months, they had been planning to kill innocent Afghans using unaccounted-for grenades.
Corporal Morlock, he took this as a target of opportunity. And Corporal Morlock was at the bottom of a hill, about 110 feet away from PFC Holmes, who was facing the opposite direction. Corporal Morlock spotted two farmers, young Afghan farmers in a field, and motioned for one of them to come over to him like this. He called the man over.
As the farmer approached, Corporal Morlock called for Private Holmes to join him at the bottom of the hill. Holmes was unaware that Morlock was about to act on his plans to kill.
When the man got to approximately 20 feet from Corporal Morlock called for PFC Holmes, who was on top of a hill. Holmes repositioned. Now, at that time, PFC Holmes started running down the hill with his squad automatic machine gun and his goggles on. It was hot that morning. Started running down the hill. Corporal Morlock was already behind about a 3-foot-high wall. The man was 20 feet away from Corporal Morlock. Corporal Morlock was going through what they call standard escalation of force procedures to ensure that the man didn't have any weapons. So he told the man in the local dialect to lift his shirt to demonstrate that there was no suicide vest, and he told him to turn around.
The man complied with Morlock's orders, clearly showing that he carried no weapons or explosives. Meanwhile, Holmes continued down the hill, stopping to take a drink and catch his breath.
About that time, PFC Holmes was getting down to the bottom of the hill behind the wall. He was out of breath. He was breathing hard. And he kneeled down to take a sip of water. Now, at that time, Corporal Morlock, again, unbeknownst to PFC Holmes, tossed a grenade over the wall. The grenade didn't go very far. It went probably 5 or 6 feet.
Morlock had told his fellow soldiers of plans to murder civilians and frame their killings as self-defense. But until that day, Holmes had not taken Corporal Morlock seriously.
Corporal Morlock's plan, and they had talked about this, PFC Holmes never thought Corporal Morlock was serious about it because it's a psychotic plan. So PFC Holmes never took him seriously. Corporal Morlock drops the grenade over the wall and screams for PFC Holmes to shoot. PFC Holmes stands up, places his squad automatic weapon on the wall, and it lets out about a 5 to 6 round burst, which with a machine gun is an instant. Now, whether the rounds actually hit the man or not, we aren't exactly sure. PFC Holmes believed they did. Forensic evidence was inconclusive on the matter. We had probably one of the leading forensic pathologists in the world, Dr. Michael Bodden, and Dr. Bodden was unable to identify any wounds in the photos of the man that were consistent with machine gun fire.
Forensic experts were unable to determine whether Holmes' shots actually hit the civilian man. During his court-martial the next year, Private Holmes said that he knew he should have taken cover against the grenade blast rather than follow Morlock's order to shoot.
Well, PFC Holmes pulled the trigger. He didn't know that the grenade had been on the ground as long as it had, and he was still standing when it was about to detonate. Corporal Morlock screamed, "Holmes, get down!" and reached up, grabbed him by the back of his uniform, and pulled him to the ground just as the grenade was detonating, and PFC Holmes nearly took shrapnel to the head from the grenade. which of course we believed killed the man.
The Stryker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Stryker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on kind of on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition, and he left his post and he went over to another area in the unit and walked through that area. He went opened one tent. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon, with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe, threw a second grenade, fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, two or three times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for initiating the attack. So Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army. Right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq, the decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he just was not capable. He was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to a brain, to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD. And it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. You know, we've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had, like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, I mean, sickening. I mean, that's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image: American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, "The gentlemen, the gloves are coming off," along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as "the gloves are coming off" suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied. Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response and said, "Gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing." And he put the orders out: "There will be no abuse in my command," and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was the message sort of was, well, we don't torture, however, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq, it went very smoothly. Within a couple of months, this insurgency developed. They hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was, do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what's going on?
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior? The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, it's going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception, but just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq? In their time coming home that would lead to this. When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there. And they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq War was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times, if these guys started losing it, the battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq, so let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I got to tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot 3 times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case. In 2010, the Army released a study on the health effects of repeated deployment. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than 3 times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served 3 or 4 tours, sometimes back to back.
In the limelight.
Almost all European countries are severely affected by the recent economic slump in the continent, but some countries are experiencing the worst economic recession in their history. There are new reports that Sweden's property market has plummeted amid a slowing consumption. Sweden is currently facing worst economic slump in EU. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted a severe slump in Sweden's real estate sector threatens to deepen a looming economic crisis in the Nordic region's largest economy. The outlet warned that after nearly 20 years of stable growth, the country's property market is undergoing a dramatic change. Housing prices have plunged by 15% from their peak in nominal terms this year, driven by surging inflation and rising borrowing costs, it said. Swedish consumers have cut spending drastically amid an unfolding cost-of-living crisis. This has brought more pain to the property sector, where economists now expect a decline in housing prices to surpass the forecast 20% drop-off. Sweden's housing market is the most vulnerable among EU states due to the country's monetary policy, which has a faster path through here than in other countries. An economist at Swedbank, Maria Wallin Fredholm, was quoted as saying, "The report indicated that about 64% of Swedes own their houses, but most people don't have long-term fixed-rate mortgages. They are therefore exposed to rising interest rates, which are now at their highest levels in more than a decade, following a series of hikes by the country's central bank. Fears are mounting that consumer spending will grind to a halt. Retail sales, along with lending, are plummeting, and there are no positive signals from the domestic economy, and especially not from households or the housing market." Annika Vins, the chief economist at Nordea Bank, warned, Household debt as a percentage of Sweden's gross domestic product stands at 90%, according to Bloomberg, meaning that higher borrowing costs will have a severe impact on consumption. A more acute risk may lie in the commercial real estate market, the Bloomberg article says, with commercial lending accounting for up to 36% of the loan books at Sweden's major financial institutions. A severe downturn in this sector could put significant pressure on the country's banks, the outlet warns. Economists warn that the situation in the property market could deteriorate further if inflation persists. Sweden is now at risk of falling into the worst recession among the 27 countries comprising the EU, analysts believe. Bloomberg had this headline in its website, writing, Sweden's free-falling property market triggers worst economic slump in EU. According to Bloomberg, soaring inflation and rising borrowing costs have sent housing prices on a steep downward trajectory across the world. But one of the places where this trend is playing out the fastest is Sweden. After a decades-long property boom fueled by cheap credit, a shortage of housing and interest-only mortgages, the Nordic region's largest economy is now in the midst of a sharp housing market contraction that threatens to deepen a looming economic slump. Home prices are down as much as 12% from their peak earlier this year when adjusted for seasonal variations, or as much as 15% in nominal terms. The plunge is happening so quickly that real world declines could exceed the 20% drop anticipated by forecasters.